My name's Helena Cobbin, and I'm here with my friend Marina Ottaway. We're going to be doing a blogging head on the Middle East, starting off with the Palestine issue and then moving on to broader Middle East topics. And, well, like I said, my name is Helena Cobbin, and I blog mainly at Just World News, and I write elsewhere. Marina, how about you?
I'm Marina Ottaway, and I direct the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I write mostly for Carnegie publications, and I've been focusing my work a lot on issues of political reform in the Arab world and Islamist movements, but also on a lot of other Middle East issues.
Well, it's great to be trying to do this thing with you. So, yeah, I guess we're going to start with the Palestinian-Israeli discussion.
The inevitable issue when one talks about the Middle East. And perhaps the good place to start is with the discussion of how is Obama doing? What has he done? He started out by announcing that the Middle East, that the peace process would have a very high degree of priority for his administration. He started out by making some important appointments, but in the end, the question is always, has anything come out of this entire process?
Well, until now, nothing has come out, and that's been very disappointing to all the people in the region who want to see this peace process succeed. He did, as you said, obviously he came out the second day in office and appointed George Mitchell and said that securing a final status peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors was a strong interest of his administration and the United States. Then he seemed to get dragged into this kind of nickel and diming negotiation over settlement construction, which at the beginning I thought it was pretty useful. I mean, it's good to clarify that issue, but it seems to have dragged on and on very indecisively and has taken a lot of time.
Right. It seems to me that trying to understand why the whole process seems to get stuck. One thing that strikes me very strongly is there is a strange similarity between what is happening with the peace process and what is happening with the debate on healthcare. That essentially, Obama said this is very important, this is very, it's something we absolutely have to do something about. But then he did not set the way, essentially. He said, you guys talk, you guys do something about this. It seems to me that is one of the factors that probably it's slowing down the process. But what else? I mean, how else do we explain why something that was supposed to have high priority has not produced anything so far?
Well, it's not that he hasn't done anything. And, he gave the great speech in Cairo in June, which I think was really helpful for reframing the issues. I was in Damascus at the time, and my hosts there, I also saw the head of Hamas while I was there, Khaled Mishaal, and I saw the foreign minister of Syria. So a lot of people then on June 4th, they were pretty impressed by the speech. So he had momentum with the speech. He had a lot of support from Palestinians, other Arabs, and Israeli peace activists back at the beginning when he took on the settlements issue, because, settlements mm-hmm. are a key issue in the region. But the fact that he never went further than the rhetoric, I think that's been the problem on the settlements. And in a sense, as you say, there is a parallel with losing the momentum on healthcare. Maybe it's something to do with Obama's personal preference for consensus and, his apparent aversion to confrontation. But you can, draw lines in the sand or make an eloquent expression of your policy preferences and your opinion, but unless you actually follow through and do something, then people are going to be saying, what are the words worth?
The problem is for somebody who essentially does not want conflict and is a consensus promoter, one of the problems, I think, is that by drawing a line at settlement construction, he has also picked an issue on which it's very difficult to reach compromise, and on which it's very difficult to proceed really without a confrontation, because the Israelis are obviously not enthusiastic, to put it mildly, at the idea of halting settlement construction, so that he almost has put himself in a situation whether either he takes a very strong stand against Israel, or he has essentially to fudge it, or not do anything in particular, which seems to be the problem at this point, at least as I read it.
Yeah, I think the settlement issue obviously is important for the Palestinian negotiators. Abu Mazen has been burned a number of times previously, mm-hmm. Almost continuously since Oslo, let's say, because he's been involved for that long, because, the Palestinian negotiators have been talking and talking and talking and taking the various steps that are required. Well, recently they've been taking the steps, and in earlier periods they did in some periods and didn't in some periods, to, suppress violent acts and suppress incitement and all those other things that they're requested to do. But meantime, over those 16 years since Oslo, the settlement construction has just continued inexorably and eaten up the potential territorial base for the independent Palestinian state. And so, Abu Mazen needs something on the settlement. My perspective is that, once you get the final peace agreement, it will have a border delineated on it, and after that, the issue of settlement construction is moot, in a sense, because anything west of the border, Israel can presumably build on, constantly.
Sure.
Like not oppressing people who live there or whatever, but anything east of the border, the Israeli government can't build because it's going to be in the Palestinian state. So once you've delineated that border, the settlement issue, in a sense, is no longer an issue.
Yes, no, at some certainly within the peace agreement, it's not, and within the delineation of borders, it's not going to be an issue. The problem is always that Palestinians feel that as the settlement construction continues now, the Israelis are trying to create effects on the ground, and therefore it becomes an extremely touchy issue. Moving a bit away from settlements, because I think we both agree that while this is very important, it's not the only issue. I'm beginning to see one point on which both sides can agree, and in fact are agreeing, but still there is a lot, despite the sort of some basic convergence of view, there is also a lot of space for disagreement, and that is the importance of improving Palestinian institutions and of developing the economy in order to move the process forward. The argument, both sides essentially are arguing that the first step in getting to a Palestinian state is to build the institution and to give the state an economic base. And there has been a lot of excitement recently about the fact that there are finally the Palestinian economy, at least on the West Bank, is giving some signs of revival from a very low.
I don't know. I tend to be very skeptical of all of that, Marina, honestly. When they say, they cite these figures about the IMF is projecting that, there'll be 7% or 9% growth this year if everything continues. You're talking about 7 or 9% growth in an economy that has been completely stifled by the roadblocks and the movement controls and everything else. So, if somebody takes his foot off your neck, like, by 1 centimeter, does that mean your neck is, thereby, suddenly in great shape? And
no, I totally agree, and I think it's very easy to... A certain growth rate means very different things when it's just recovery from a terribly difficult situation. In other words, if you had businesses that were closed because they could not get raw material, and suddenly they get raw material, they are producing more, you can have a pretty good figures in the short run. It does not mean that the economy is developing. I completely agree on that point. But are you discounting the importance of economic progress in terms of providing, a base on which to build a peace agreement?
I think I am, honestly. Once you get an independent Palestinian economy that can develop its own priorities, its own development priorities, its own international relationships with the rest of the world economy, They can do that. You know, the Palestinians have built states and economies up and down the Arabian Persian Gulf. They know how to do that. They're a highly educated population. They've run state administrations. They've created stock exchanges. They've done all that.
And there is a lot of money in the Palestinian community,
yeah, I mean,
which we often forget. That.
So, you know, we're not talking about Afghanistan. We're not talking about a place where people don't have, you know, basic literacy and stuff like that. We're talking about a very capable and experienced population of people. They created a lot of institutions in the 1990s. You know, Sharon went in 2002, destroyed them. And the same in Gaza. There was, you know, modest hope for economic and social development in the 1990s. And, you know, first of all, you had Sharon's attack in 2002. Now you've got the siege. I mean, we can't forget about the continued strangulation of Gaza. It's all very well for people to look at what's happening in the West Bank.
But it's, you know, even going forward, though, you say once the Palestinians get the control over their economy and so on, are they ever going to really get control over their own economy, in the sense that even if, you know, even being optimistic, perhaps against a reason, but even in the best case scenario, that there is going to be an independent Palestinian state, it's still going to be an enclave. It's still going to be highly dependent on transit through Israel. I mean, that's a geography. There is no...
Well, you know, they will need to have a roadway or whatever through Israel, but they will have direct connection, you know, with Jordan through the West Bank and with Egypt through Gaza and with the sea, you know, through Gaza's coast and through airports. I mean, you know, Salam Fayyad, to his credit, is talking about precisely that kind of infrastructure in terms of preparing for the direct connection between an independent Palestine and the world economy, which you never had, of course, under Oslo, because under Oslo, which was always just an interim agreement, the PA was always subservient to Israel economically and had no possibility of direct connection with the world economy. It always had to go through Israel, which is why, you know, it's been a constant irritant. No, if you have an independent Palestinian state, it will be directly connected to the world economy. Otherwise, it's not going to be an independent Palestinian state.
Yes, well, yes, of course, there will be direct connections to the world economy. I find it difficult to believe that, given the situation, there are not going, you know, there is the connect, sort of the ties between the Palestinian economy and the Israeli economy are not always going to be extremely strong, and probably in a negative sense for the Palestinians, because yes, there will be passage through the sea through Gaza if you have a real state, but there is always going to be a bottleneck in the communication between the West Bank and Gaza. Even you know, even if there is a corridor that is provided and open, it's not going to be the same degree of movement, the same ease of integration of the two parts of a Palestinian state that you'd get under a different geography.
Well, you know, they're very close. We're not talking about, you know, East Pakistan, West Pakistan. We're talking, you know, about it's what, 25 miles? It's less than 25 miles. I don't see that as a particular bottleneck.
Right. Well, I would disagree on that. I mean, I think, unfortunately, that there are going to be lasting problems no matter how it's done. There is no doubt at the same time that the situation can become infinitely better than it is under these conditions that I think you correctly characterized as strangulation so far. But in a sense, we are getting stuck talking more about what would happen if we reach a statehood. We are not there yet. And I think one of the questions is, okay, we talked about the settlements, we talked about the fact that sort of Obama has lost momentum, but what is there in the present situation that can generate some momentum to try to move the situation that has been blocked for such a long period of time?
Well, you know, I think what the president needs to do is to come out very clearly and say it's in the direct national interest of the United States to see this thing resolved, to see a conflict-ending peace agreement between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors. Until now, a lot of the statements have stressed that we're doing this for the long-term benefit of Israel or for the long-term security of Israel. That's a completely wrong way to cast it, because then, you know, all you need is the Israeli government to come back, as it has done, and say, no, we don't see things that way, you know. But if once he starts to cast it as being in the direct interest of the United States, which is something I strongly believe to be the case, you know, we have very broad and deep interests throughout the whole Middle East, and the fact that this conflict continues in this very damaging way is a continuous drag on the true interests of the American citizenry. I would like to see the president say that and take the actions, you know, individually with the parties, with the Arab neighbors, and with the international community that would, you know, show that he's serious about securing this peace.
Well, I mean, yes, and I think the U.S. should, I mean, it is the duty of the U.S. president to act in the interest of the United States, but a declaration of the sort of that sort by Obama would certainly cause a huge, it would be very welcome by the Palestinian and by Arab countries. It would create a howl of protest in Israel that the United States is essentially no longer providing the support for Israel that it's, you know, that it pledged to provide in the past. Do you see this as a complicating factor? In other words, is this going to make the Israelis more difficult to deal with for the Obama administration?
I mean, I'm not suggesting for a moment, and I don't think the, you know, it's likely that the president would say something like this, that he's going to turn his back on Israel. But I think he needs to say that it's not just in Israel's interest, it's also in our interest to see this happen. And for goodness sake, the Israelis are quite, you know, comfortable about pursuing their own national interests, and surely, you know, we'll respect the American president if he says that he wants to pursue our national interests as well. There are still huge overlaps. I mean, it's not a hostile act to say that, you know, the U.S. president is going to pursue the U.S. national interest.
No, but by saying that, it does not have to be that way, but by saying that, he's also suggesting something that the Israelis have resisted in the past, that is the suggestion that U.S. interests and Israeli interests are not necessarily identical, which was certainly the position that was taken by the Bush administration. So that I think it's a considerable change in the position of the United States, or it will
be interpreted that way. It's a return to the first Bush administration, actually, you know, when President George H.W. Bush and Secretary of State James Baker said, you know, they got the parties in Madrid, and they did so by saying this is in our interest, even though Shamir, Prime Minister Shamir at the time, very right-wing, Likud Prime Minister, was dragged kicking and screaming to Madrid. And then they said, you know, that we think that the Shamir government, the government of Israel, should not be building additional settlements, and we will hold them accountable in a financial way for any, you know, investment that goes into the settlements. And Shamir didn't like it. Of course he didn't like it. You know, it was one of the few times that Washington tugged on his leash and said, you know.
Yes, yes.
So I think that succeeded. That succeeded in getting the Shamir government to the Madrid Peace Conference. And everything we've seen that has been good in peacemaking since then has come from the Madrid Peace Conference. You know, the Israeli-Jordanian peace, Oslo when it was hopeful, you know, that all came from Madrid.
We are talking about putting pressure on Israel to move towards, on the issue of settlements, on other issues, by trying to make it clear that the U.S. has its own national interest to protect, and those interests, while not conflict, that can be a different interpretation of what U.S. interests are, different from the one that Israel is doing. So this puts a lot of pressure pressure on Israel. What about the Palestinians? Do they need to be dragged kicking and screaming somewhere?
I think it's good if we talk about the Palestinian politics of all this, because it's obviously a huge portion of what what we, you know, what needs to happen. And it's very complicated because, you know, they have such a complex internal political situation. You've got the two big Palestinian parties, Fatah and Hamas, contesting for, you know, to be considered as representatives of the Palestinian people. Obviously, our government and the other governments in the quartet, that is United Nations, Russia, and the EU, are not supposed to be talking to Hamas right now, although the Russians do, quite clearly, and some of the European governments.
European governments also do, yeah.
Some, not all.
No, but some, quite a few of them do. I mean, that's
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, there's this huge bad blood within the Palestinian movement over all the stuff that has happened in the last, well, in the last 15 years, but most particularly in the last 3 years since there was the election, and Hamas won the parliamentary election. And then Fatah actually worked with the Bush administration and with the government of Israel to try to unseat Hamas. And Hamas repelled that, and so now you have a situation where Hamas is effectively in control of Gaza, which has, what, 1.3 million people,
mm-hmm.
1.5 million people,
right.
And Fatah is effectively in control in the West Bank. But the institutions of the interim Palestinian administration are all bifurcated between the two. And then there's the PLO. It's the PLO that should be doing the final status negotiations. So now they are starting to fight over, you know, representation in the PLO.
Right.
That's kind of interesting, actually, because the head of the PLO, Salim Zaanoun, I forget what his head of the I guess he's the speaker of the PLO's parliament,
okay.
which is the PNC, is apparently on his way to Gaza to go and talk to Hamas about Hamas representation inside the PLO.
Which is a very interesting issue, that the fact that Hamas is even, you know, is interested enough in I mean, in a sense, I think we Hamas is much more interested in negotiations than they would allow in public. The fact that they want to be represented in this negotiating team, I mean, it tells you something about the reality there.
Well, you know, I'm not sure they want to be actually directly represented in it, but they want the negotiating team to consider itself accountable to them in some way.
Well,
not necessarily to
sure,
their people.
It's a way of fudging the issue of whether or not they are willing to negotiate, but in fact
that's right. But definitely when I saw Khaled Mishaal and interviewed him in Damascus back in June, he was very clear. He said, we want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Right, right. And he has said that on a number of occasions.
That's right.
This issue of reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas, which obviously is central to any movement forward, I worry a lot that too much responsibility has been left to the Egyptian government to try and mediate. I mean, I think this is something which really needs to be discussed, because and what you see is, first of all, I'm not sure that certainly the Egyptian government is not a neutral party in this. It's certainly there is not much love lost between Hamas and the Egyptian government. But what makes it even worse to me is the fact that the negotiations seems to be conducted much more by the security services than by diplomats. And in that sense, I'm not sure that this is the best way to proceed at this point.
Well, you know, Egypt is basically still a national security state, even though, you know, it has many of the appurtenances of a democracy. But I think you and I both know that the real power is still with the security.
More and more clearly, I would say, or more and more openly.
And you know, yeah. as we mentioned, well, we haven't mentioned it yet, but, you know, they're entering a kind of period of very tough succession struggle, so the security forces are going to be even more jealous of their prerogatives during that period, during that transition period, I think. Now, what's been interesting about Egypt's role, in a sense, with the Palestinian negotiations has been that they've they monopolize all the negotiations in which Hamas has any interest,
yes,
or role. And on the one, on the prisoner negotiations, which is where Egypt has been mediating between Hamas and Israel, in the end, both parties, both the direct parties to that negotiation, said, you know, to heck with the Egyptians, they're not getting us anywhere, and so they brought in the Germans.
Yes.
And so, you know, you now have German and Norwegian negotiators on that one, which means I think that both Hamas and Israel are pretty serious about it.
Yes. And it also means something else. I mean, going back to the point that we made before about the Europeans being willing to talk to Hamas, that there is beginning to be, at least on the part of some Europeans, a recognition that there is no way in which there can be a deal where there is no way to make progress towards peace simply by through a process that only involves the Israelis and Fatah, that Hamas has to be brought in, and whatever one might a particular government thinks of Hamas, the fact is that Hamas needs to be brought in one way or another. But what I think we also need to look at the Israeli side, because as much certainly conditions among the Palestinians are not the most conducive to negotiations right now because of this split between Hamas and Fatah, the difficulty that they are encountering for whatever reason, because of the mediator, because of their own problems and so on, in overcoming this conflict. What about the Palestinians? What about the Israeli side?
Just before we leave the Palestinians,
yes,
though, I mean, I do want to underline that Hamas people for quite some time now have been saying that even though they don't want to be the ones doing the negotiating, they do want to see any peace agreement that is concluded sent to a referendum of all the Palestinian people, which is an interesting and important idea, because that includes the Palestinian in the diaspora, as well as the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and that as per the results of that referendum, Hamas will abide by the results.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that's a very interesting and potentially
That's important. I mean, I think that's interesting and it's important, but in a sense, what is missing is the intermediate step. Because an intermediate step is, can Hamas and Fatah, in fact, cooperate in coming to this point where there is an agreement? And right now it seems to me that cooperation is not as strong as it could be. There are a lot of problems still that on which not much progress is being made. I mean, one can hope that the German and Norwegian will do a little better, but certainly so far, the last time that Hamas and Fatah agreed was on the Mecca Agreement of 2006, right? Mm-hmm. So that has been quite a while now. 2007, sorry, yeah.
But, I mean, I guess just the person whose name we haven't mentioned very much at all in all of this is George Mitchell, who is supposed to be the special peace envoy. And, you know, when he was named, everybody was so excited about, you know, this is the guy who brought peace to Northern Ireland. And since then, he has been operating in such a low-key way. He's been to the region 5 or 6 or 7 times.
He's there now, right? Or arriving there?
Well, he's always coming or going, but, you know, he's operating at such a low-key way. Either, you know, he's not achieving very much, or else he's achieving unbelievable things which will all be unwrapped one day soon.
Which we all would like to be the case. But let's go
to the Israeli side
for a moment. Yeah.
Yeah, how do you see it, Marina?
Well, I should preface this by saying I'm not an expert on Israeli politics. I tend to look at the other side, but I think one of the constant problem of Israeli politics is that the government coalitions are extremely fragile, so that it's not just a question of how much the government is willing to go, how much Netanyahu in this in this case is willing to make concessions, but also literally how far can he go before the coalition falls apart. And this can be an excuse, but it's also very real, because the Israeli governments, as we know, fall apart all the time.
I mean, I have a question as to whether how much we should care if the Netanyahu government falls apart.
Well, we should care in the sense that until it postpones any possibility of negotiation, it postpones any possibility of talks, because if the Israeli government, if the present cabinet falls apart, if the present coalition falls apart, it's going to be several months before we have another government to work with. And in that sense, we should care. It's not that this, from the point of view of the peace process, this is certainly not a great government. But the fact is that you need some government to have any hope of progress. And there is, being without a government for a while means entering into another hiatus.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And meantime, if this government falls, the prospects are that it, you know, unless the peace issue gets substantially reframed by someone, whether in Israel or in this country or elsewhere, there's a real danger that what you might get is an even more right-wing government in Israel because of these deep trends in Israeli society. I'm not a specialist in Israeli affairs, but I've been going there for 25 years and have a lot of friends in the Israeli peace movement and some colleagues, you know, who are Israeli specialists on peacemaking and strategic affairs who are not necessarily in the peace movement. And they all say that the peace movement has just undergone this huge decline. And in fact,
yes.
I wrote an article about this recently. One of the ways this is manifested, well, it's manifested in a lot of different ways. You can see it obviously in the results of the elections, where the Meretz party, which traditionally was the
pro-peace
party, has just, you know, withered on the vine. And in fact, during the early days of the war in Gaza last December, the leaders of Meretz came out in support of the war, which was so confusing
for
so many of their longtime supporters. In fact, you're seeing a lot of pro-peace Israelis coming to this country now, which is interesting. It's really livened up the discussion in this country,
yes.
I think.
Well, a lot of things have livened up the discussion in this country. There is much more variety of points of view openly being expressed by Jewish organizations. The appearance of the J Street group certainly has livened
up
the
debate.
Yeah, J
Street, and
J Street, but you know, several others. And so, There is a greater variety of voices speaking on this issue in the United States.
And meantime, you know, what we all used to look at as the great white hope of the peace movement in Israel, which has always had some really wonderful people in it, people that you and I know, and a lot of people. They just give this feeling of being embattled and surrounded and almost defeated.
Yes.
I talked with my friend Yossi Alfer when
yes.
I was there.
Yes, I was thinking of some of his columns as a matter of fact on this topic.
Yeah, and one notable thing that he said, and he's somebody with whom I've been friends for a long time, is that there's a notable new dynamic that for the first decades of its existence, Israel and most of the Israelis really craved good relations with their Arab neighbors,
right.
And they wanted to be recognized in the region and to be, you know, accepted as part of the region. And of course, right now, a lot of what's going on at the diplomatic level has to do with, you know, getting the Arabs to make sort of confidence-building measures and blah blah blah. You know, to kind of reassure the Israelis that if the Israelis give up the Palestinian territory, then they will have, you know, these wonderful relations with all the Arab countries, including the rich Arab countries. And what Yossi was saying when we were sitting there in February talking about this, he said most Israelis now couldn't give a toss about the Arab world or the Middle East. You know, that the wall that they have built between them and the Palestinians is not just between them and the Palestinians, in a sense. It's representative of so many Jewish Israelis turning their back on the Middle East. And he pointed out that now, you know, you have a lot of Israelis who have passports from, you know, Hungary or Poland or places in East Europe that their grandparents or parents have fled from.
Right, who really don't have any ties to the region.
Yeah, or you have, you know, Israelis, he said, who will commute on a weekly basis to jobs in Copenhagen or London or Genoa or whatever. So they're very focused on being part of Israel and part of Europe, you know, both East Europe and West Europe. And, of course, many of them have historic ties with East Europe that they weren't able to pursue under, you know, so long as you were
Earlier,
And so the idea that, you know, some Saudi sheikh is going to offer them a share in his company, like, who needs it? You know, there's this real back-turning.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting. That's new.
Yeah, there is a back-turning, but still, I mean, to some extent it's also a bit of an illusion, not in economic terms, in the sense that clearly the Israeli economy is not tied to the economies of the Middle East. Israel at this point is almost totally delinked from the economies of the Middle East. But there is still an issue of security. There is still an issue of, it's very difficult for Israel, for Israelis to totally feel secure in that region unless the relations with the rest of the Middle East improve.
I mean
security barrier may give a sense of safety, but obviously it's not a replacement for for changing the relations with all countries in the region.
So maybe we should move on to some of the other issues in the region, since we're now looking at the region.
Yes, I think so.
I'm going to ask you the big question as to why does the Middle East continue to be so undemocratic?
That is a very important question. That is a real issue there. Okay, why? I mean, first of all, let me point out something that while it is true that if you look at the Freedom House Index, and which is, you know, it's still the only index we have on this issue, the Middle East consistently comes at the bottom of all the regions in the world. There are many areas in the world where there is almost complete lack of democracy. I mean, it's not just the Middle East, it's Central Asia and many, many parts of
Sub-Saharan Africa.
And many parts of Asia, other parts of Asia as well, where you have much more facade democracy than real democracy. So,
and then there's something like 1.3 billion people in China.
a small thing. So that it's not that it's not, after all, that that the Arabs are so unique. What I think the problem is that if you try to analyze, and we have done a lot of work trying to understand this, why is it that it is so difficult to bring any change on the issue in the Middle East, is that the most striking thing to me is how weak the opposition in Arab countries are, how poorly organized the opposition in Arab countries is. And that is for two reasons. One is that the fact that the most Middle Eastern states are really security states. I mean, they are extremely well organized from the point of view of security, and they are getting better. In other words, they are not only security states, but they are competent security states. I think whether or not you like it, the mukhabarat in many Arab countries is very good. The security services are very good, so that they are very much,
I think, rather than good, I might say efficient.
Efficient, yes. That's the word I used originally. They are very efficient. They know how to, they know how to gather information. They know how to be on top of the situation. So that puts an enormous crimp on the capacity of opposition groups to organize, even opposition groups that try to act legally, even opposition groups that are trying to enter the legal or are involved in the legal political process in their country. I'm not talking about extremist groups, but, for example, liberal parties in Egypt, not radical parties, and they come immediately under you know, they appear immediately on the radar screen of the security services, and they are immediately repressed. And there is the famous case of Ayman Nour and Al Haq Party. Ayman Nour
and Saadeddine Ibrahim.
Saadeddine Ibrahim and so on. People that could not in any way pose a danger to the regime. They were not going to gain power. Some of them did not even try. I mean, they were not even competing for power. But even somebody like Ayman Nour, who ran for president, there was no way he was going to win the presidency and so on. But the regime immediately cracked down on them. Now, so you have this problem of the efficiency of the apparatus, but you also have great shortcomings on the part of the opposition groups in terms of being able to develop a message which is appealing to the population, to really convince the population that they have something to offer. And I think, and I'd like to put in this group of political organizations that have trouble developing a message, the Islamist parties. And I think this is somewhat against conventional wisdom, because there was a great deal of worry on the part of Arab regimes, but also on the part of Western governments, that Islamist parties were about to take over, that if something was not done, Islamist parties would win elections and come to power, and then that would be the end of any possible democratic development in these regions. The reality is very different, that if you look at the Islamist parties, they are in pretty bad shape now. They have not been very good at convincing the population. And you cannot just say it's all because of government repression. Government repression is very real. These parties they have suffered tremendously. I mean, the number of people in prison. But they have not convinced the population that they really have a lot to offer.
I think I saw that very intensely when I was in Egypt back in February.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just right in the aftermath of the Gaza war, and so many people had been saying during the Gaza war, you know, well, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who, you know, are so closely tied to Hamas, will certainly be making things very, very hot indeed for the Mubarak regime in Egypt. And you get there, and there's no sign of the Muslim Brotherhood doing anything.
Right.
And in fact, people who were the Egyptian government clamped down very, very hard on any signs of solidarity action amongst the Egyptian population with the people of Gaza during the war. And so there were, you know, few small scattered demonstrations. And when there were demonstrations that, you know, leftists and liberals were part of, and sometimes a few people from the Brotherhood, but the Brotherhood people there were always intent on curbing the militancy of the demonstration and saying, no, we're not going to challenge the regime, we just want to express solidarity, we can't have any slogans that criticize the regime. And you know, they didn't do very much, but what they did was extremely conservative, which surprised so many people. But then I think Mubarak was very clever, and he and his advisors, who include some people that you and I probably know, made this into an issue of Egyptian national sovereignty. And, you know, I was driving around the military part of Masr al-Gadida, Heliopolis, out near the airport, and you see these big signs saying, Egypt first.
Yes, but on other issues it's not. No, that is certainly true, but on other issues, for example, on domestic issues, that's also where the Islamist parties have not convinced people. Take the case of Morocco, for example, what is interesting, I mean, the Islamist party, the Party for Justice and Development in Morocco, is the second largest party in the country. But if you look at how many, and it can operate fairly freely, but when you look at how many people actually voted, and not only the fact that the voter turnout was low, but also the fact that one-third of the people who bothered to cast a ballot in the last election deliberately spoiled the ballot. Not the person with the dirty fingers that leaves marks where they shouldn't and confuses the issue, but people who drew a huge black cross on the, you know, across the ballot, mm-hmm. leaving no doubt that they wanted to invalidate. shows that a lot of people in the Arab world don't see an alternative to the present regimes. They don't like the present regimes, but they essentially, when they have to choose for somebody else, in the end they choose none of the above. And that includes the Islamist parties. So that essentially what is really the most striking thing is that there is a desire for change in the Arab world. Nobody who has been there recently can, in talking to people, can deny that there is a desire for change. It's not that Arabs are happy the way things are, but they really, they don't see the alternatives at this point. They don't see the organization, they don't see the agendas that could make a difference. And that leads to what I think right now is truly a situation of stagnation in the region.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking in the region for really efficient and well-run Islamist parties, the best place to go is Turkey, actually.
Yes.
Which, of course, people who watch this will no doubt know this, is not an Arab country.
Yes.
And is ruled by this intentionally Islamist party that is also intentionally moderate and pro-Western. I think it's such a fascinating combination. Because they're very eager to get into the EU.
Yes.
They're very, happy to be in NATO, although, of course, they did object to the invasion of Iraq, quite correctly, from my perspective.
Yes, yes. From mine too.
But, and I was in Turkey, and they are now starting Kurdish language education.
Yes.
They are resolving a lot of the historical issues with Armenia. They are mediating between Syria and Iraq in this latest spat between Syria and Iraq. Things that you could not have imagined a Turkish government doing
right.
in the region. And running their country extremely well.
Yes. Well, no, this is true. I mean, I would be somewhat less, perhaps a little less sanguine than you are on how far they have gone in addressing the Armenian issues and in addressing the Kurdish issue. Better
but
than
they haven't
it was.
Resolved it, but they've got, you can't deny that they've taken
no,
some positive
they have made, they have taken some positive steps but the
steps
but
that we never saw from the secular leaders
right
of
but my point is really that also how long it has taken them to get there. In other words, they made a lot of false they made false starts so too early on, and it took them a while to get to where they are now.
And they've been hampered by the security apparatus there. I mean they've had to really negotiate a fine line in their relations with the Turkish
right.
military. So
well, I think unfortunately in that region, any opposition party has to deal with the security apparatus, and it's going to be hampered by the security apparatus, including, as we were saying earlier, the more moderate of the pro-Western liberal parties, essentially.
So tell me what you think, Marina. Do you think if the Arab-Israeli issue gets resolved, that all these national security states will have to change?
Not immediately. I mean, I think it... No, I don't think...
Because they do use the conflict with Israel as a kind of excuse.
Yeah, but they use it as an excuse. And whether historically it was real or not, that's something that's open to debate, and perhaps this is not the time to get into that debate, but because it would take a long time, not because I don't want to have that debate. But I think at this point, those security apparatuses exist, and they are very powerful, and they are just not going to go poof and disappear because there is an agreement with Israel. Whether or not, in the next 30 years, it might make it easier to start dismantling some of the security apparatuses, perhaps. But keep in mind that most of the crackdown by the security on the domestic political scene in Arab countries has absolutely nothing to do with
Israel. They justify it to their public in as much as a justification
I don't think the public buys it any longer. I think the public very frankly knows exactly what's going on. The problem is that these are pretty powerful machines, and there is not and they are not so easy to dismantle.
You know, I think we have a great segue here to talking about Iraq, actually, which I would like us to talk about.
Yes.
Because we only have about 10 minutes left.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that, as Americans talking about the Middle East, if we don't talk about Iraq, then I think we're lacking in
attention
to duty.
Yeah.
Do you think that Iraq is going back to civil war? And if so, what do you think the United States should do about that?
I am not ready to say that Iraq is going back to civil war. I think it's too early in this. Okay, what is happening in Iraq? Just to remind briefly people, remind listeners briefly. Certainly, what we have seen in the last few months is the pendulum beginning to swing back in the direction of more violence. The worst time in Iraq was in 2006. Then with the surge, the country became much more stable, became much less violent, and now we are beginning to see an uptick in violence again, certainly not to the levels of 2006. I think what we are beginning to see is different groups testing their strength and see how far they can go. That at least is my reading of the situation.
Which is not surprising, you know, given that the U.S. power is clearly receding, so the idea that, you know, the Iraqi parties are going to be testing their strength.
Absolutely,
you know.
And they're testing their strengths in all sorts of different ways. Testing their strengths on the parliamentary level. There is, in preparation for this election, there is a lot of jockeying for position, a lot of elections in January 2010. There is a lot of experimenting with different alliances, different breakdowns, and so on. How it's going to work out, we don't know. But there is also a lot of testing of the limits of what you can achieve with violence at this point. You can see, for example, in the border area between Kurdistan and the rest of Iraq, which is not just the city of Kirkuk, but it's a much larger area, that what we are beginning to see, it's a lot of, you know, movement of people, movement of the Peshmerga, that is the Kurdish militias, and of the Iraqi National Forces, and literally trying to take over more land, try to occupy more land, and so on and so forth. So there is, and then of course you have more of these terrorist attacks that are taking place. Now it is very difficult, at least to me, at this point, to judge how many of these violent acts are just a testing of the water and say, you know, how far can we push, and how much it's really the beginning of the free-for-all that led to the civil war in the past. I am not sure that we can. Probably there are different groups with different intentions. I think there is no doubt that elements of Al-Qaeda are raising their head again and so on. On the other hand, I think, for example, in the border between Kirkuk and the Kirkuk between Kurdistan and the rest of Iraq, it's more of a testing of the water and trying to gain little advantages on the ground and so on and so forth. So it's not necessarily the return to civil war. At the same time, I think there is nobody who can say with any degree of certainty that a return to civil war is impossible. How do you see it?
I think the most dangerous thing that's on the horizon is the prospect of fighting between the Kurdish and Arab portions of the country. I know there are unresolved sectarian issues, but I've seen quite a resurgence of sort of pan-Arab solidarity bridges and movements between Shiites and Sunnis. It's not peace in our time or anything for them. And there are still huge sectarian sensitivities, and a lot of it's being sort of fomented by the Saudis, I think, unfortunately, because, you know, they're, as always, very... I'm not accusing the Saudi government, but I think private Saudi individuals,
right,
and, you know, powerful tribal sheikhs who are, you know, in Saudi Arabia but on
mm-hmm.
that border, they're still very unhappy at seeing the diminution of Sunni power inside Arab Iraq. But I think there, having said that, there's still a lot going on across the sectarian line between Shiites and Sunnis, and they are starting to really face up to how can they contain Kurdish power, because Kurdish power has been, in a sense, artificially inflated in the country. The Kurds make up, what, 17% of the population, but they've had a disproportionate amount of power in the central Baghdad government that was installed by the Americans in 2003. So I think my big concern is some kind of big fighting between the Arabs and Kurds in
Iraq. It depends. I don't know how likely that is on a large scale, and let me tell you why. Because it seems to me that if you look at what's happening on the ground in the border area, as I was talking before and so on, and at some of the declarations that are being made, there is this Arab-Kurdish divide that that seems to be becoming more pronounced right now. If you look at the parliamentary politics of that country, which is very intense, and I think it's very real. In other words, I think there are two ways of generating power in Iraq at this point. One is the legal way through the election process and so on, which is real. It's not democratic, but I think it's a real process that people are using.
There is definitely parliamentary
that people are using. And then there is the extra-parliamentarian way to generate power. If you look at the parliamentary politics, then what you see is that there are still very strong alliances between the Kurds and the Shia. So that it's not, the Shia still have not decided which way they want to jump. And the Shias, of course, in this election process, the Shias are very divided. You know that there is, it's not clear whether the al-Maliki is going to join the Shia coalition, which also contains Kurds in the election, or is going to play the nationalist card, which essentially means an Arab card. So, and that then would probably affect also the situation on the non-parliamentary politics. But I don't think al-Maliki, at least as far as I can ascertain, has made that decision yet.
I think you're right. I mean, we also need to mention Iranians as major power groups behind the scenes there. And the fact that the Iranians have relations with people from all the different groups, every single group, whether they're contending against each other or in alliance with each other, probably have some relationship with Iran. So to me, it looks very similar to the situation, to the role that Syria played in Lebanon in those many years when it was the kind of...
And that may very well be a factor that is going to keep Maliki to take, to play essentially the Arab nationalist card. Because if he plays the Arab nationalist card, then of course it risks incurring the displeasure of the Iranians, and then setting himself up against the Iranians. Iranians have been very good that they have played all sides. I mean, they have supported as far as I know, they have supported every Shia faction I know of. But
And probably every Kurdish faction.
And probably every Kurdish
most
faction.
Most of the Sunni factions as well.
But if Maliki was to play openly much more of an Arab nationalist card, then I think he would get into trouble with the Iranians, and he probably knows this.
Yeah, I think they probably all know each other pretty well at the end of 6 years.
Oh yeah, I think there is no doubt about that. But so I think what really makes Iraq so difficult to read now is the fact that there are these two parallel political processes: the parliamentary process on one side, and then the sort of the much more of the raw power, the quest for
the militias and the security units, exactly.
And the relationship between, unfortunately, the truth of the matter is that we really don't understand very much about Iraqi politics, because most of what we hear because there it is still so difficult to operate on the ground in Iraq. Most of what we hear is really filtered through the U.S. embassy and the U.S. government. I mean, even
you can certainly look at Iraqi media to a certain extent.
You can look to Iraqi media to a certain extent. In fact, we started a research project to try and figure out really how much information that's not available in other ways you can gather through the Iraqi media. It's not easy. I mean, you can try to do other things, but there is nothing that replaces being able to go around and talk to people, and we are not there at this point.
And honestly, I'm not sure how much people in the U.S. embassy there know these days. I mean, what the conversation we've had up till now, you know, we've mentioned a lot of actors, but we haven't even mentioned the U.S. and what it can do and what it should do.
Well, the U.S. is, I mean, I think what the U.S. can do is fairly limited, because they had limited influence politically even at the height of the surge. If you remember, at one point we were talking about political benchmarks that the United
it was such a colonialist project.
But
and then now they're doing it for Afghanistan.
But the fact is, it was not a good idea. And in fact, one of the victories of the of Ryan Crocker, the then U.S. ambassador, was that he stopped everybody from talking about benchmarks. But the point is that the U.S. was trying to get the Iraqis to do certain things politically, and none of those benchmarks was met. In other words, the capacity to influence the actions of the Iraqi government and Iraqi political actors were very limited at the height of the surge. It's difficult to believe that we are going to have more influence or we are going to be more successful at the same time as we are withdrawing the number of troops. In other words, it's more and more difficult for the U.S. to have an impact.
Yeah, I think actually both, you know, the limits on U.S. power in Iraq and the limits on U.S. power in Afghanistan are vivid illustrations of the return of geography. I mean, the idea that the U.S. is kind of in any way capable of telling or figuring out what Afghans need to do to deal with each other or Iraqis strikes me as ridiculous.
Yes.
And I think...
And I think it's, I totally agree with you on that, and perhaps this is as good as any time to stop the conversation. Maybe we'll pick it up another time, but we are running out of time now.
Well, that's true. It's really been great talking to you, Marina. Maybe something
we'll
put down together.
Same here. That's right. We should do it again, maybe in a different
format. Yeah,
we
should do it again here and in real life.
Okay.
As well.
Very good. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you. Bye.